Welcome to the Depicting the Invisible podcast. I'm Susan J. Barron. I'm a contemporary artist, and my body of work, Depicting the Invisible, is a portrait series of veterans suffering from PTSD. This work is in direct response to the 22 veterans who commit suicide every day in this country. This portrait series is currently on exhibition at the Hunter Museum of American Art and the National Veterans Memorial and Museum. In each podcast, we focus on one of the portraits from the Depicting the Invisible portrait series and do a deeper dive into the issues raised in these veterans' stories. Now, one of the things that I find really interesting about doing a podcast about art is visualizing the work for the listening audience. But before I do that today, I would like to introduce a very special guest. Sue Coe is considered one of the foremost political artists working today. Critic Donald Cuspit hailed her as the greatest living practitioner of confrontational revolutionary art. Sue's mission of creating socially conscious art has taken her to prisons, AIDS wards, slaughterhouses, places the public seldom sees or wants to see. Her work is in collections of many museums, including the Museum of Modern Art, the Whitney Museum of American Art, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Smithsonian American Art Museum, the Birmingham Museum of Art, the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston, the Cooper Hewitt Museum. Folks, she is on fire. And I am so delighted to have her here today on the Depicting the Invisible podcast. Welcome, Sue Coe.
Thank you, Susan.
I have chosen Rena's portrait for us to discuss today. Rena's portrait is a 72-inch by 72-inch mixed-media work on canvas. It's composed of photographic imagery, paint, and text. There are three boxes surrounding her, each with a hashtag within, that are all connected by graffitied lines and arrows. They show that military sexual assault, the Me Too movement, and PTSD are all connected. Rena is sitting in a chair. She leans forward, elbows on her thighs, her hands covering her mouth. She makes direct eye contact with the viewer. Her expression almost says, "You have no idea what I've been through." When we were setting up the photo shoot, Rena had on a lovely black dress. She suddenly left saying, "I have to change." She came back with these jeans on that are totally torn up, and I thought they looked like they'd been attacked. I thought, yes, that is so much better. I positioned her image in the lower two-thirds of the canvas to communicate a smallness and a vulnerability. The background is painted out in an abstract black-on-black camouflage background, removing any time and place reference and also creating a sense of isolation that Rena often spoke of. Graffitied over the portrait is Rena's story in her own words, and it begins and ends with quotation marks, and this is her story. "I joined the Army after college because I wanted to be a medic. I wanted to save people in Africa, but God has other plans for us. A star soldier raped me. Who is going to believe me? My BFF doesn't believe me, then who will? I am deployed with my rapist. I am sworn to do my duty as a medic, but I cannot bear to save this guy who raped me. The worst part of our society is that we don't believe women when they come forward. Why would we want to make up something so bad about ourselves? Of course, they're not lying." So, Sue, maybe we could just start with your response to this work.
It's an extraordinary portrait that reminds me a lot of Velázquez. When I was looking at it, where what you've done with this body of work is you've depicted the court, all of the court, as Velázquez depicted the court, from the king down to the lowliest courtiers, with such an astute insight where there is no class division. There's just his perspicacity, which you have in this portrait. And I looked at it, it's can and not. So I don't know if that's you just copied what she said, Rena, or if that was deliberate, can or not. Not cannot, it was can or not. Because the image, she comes off as a lioness. And that was the first thing I saw when I looked at her face. She's a protector. You know, it's never the lions that protect. It's the lioness. And so her whole being is a medic. She wants to protect. Can she protect the rapist? Can or not? It's not one word. In her mind, you can see that in her face. The face has a direct gaze, and the jeans are shredded beyond the fashion statement. So that's what I noticed. They look like she's been attacked by a lion, but she has the look, the feline look of the protector. And all this is so beautifully powerful, the gaze and how you've, and I wanted to ask you that, how much input did she have in the choice? So when she went and said, I've got to change out of a dress, which the shredded jeans are not just a fashion statement of the time, they're literally shredded, like she's been attacked.
Yeah.
Did she choose? Did you choose? How does that work when you're doing something so profound and respectful of sharing someone's story? How do you both choose?
Totally up to her how she wanted to be depicted. I set the stage. I set the lighting. I wanted it to be sort of this classical black and white portraiture, rather elegant in contrast to the story that we're telling. And that's why I thought it was so interesting that she started with the black dress and was like, no. And when she came back with those jeans, I just thought, perfect. You know, one of the things when I was working on her portrait, one of the things that I kept on coming back to, I kept on thinking about, was the centuries old tradition of men glorifying rape in paintings. Mm-hmm. And who has told this story? Like, think of Titian's Rape of Europa, or Rubens' Rape of the Sabine Women, or Rubens' Susanna and the Elders, which I think is particularly creepy. You know, I was thinking, can art about rape create compassion? Can it make in us this, create in us this sense that we cannot accept what is not acceptable? And that's what I was really thinking about when I was creating this portrait.
Well, there's another point in the portrait I'm noticing with that male gaze. We rarely see a female gaze unless they are the subject of their gazing back. Is that on one wrist, she has a watch. So a watch is very important to her, but it's not cosmetic. It's not a fashion statement. The watch has a steel band. So she needs that watch. But on the other wrist, it's very delicate bracelets. So in a sense, this the subject is projecting two ways of seeing her. As this delicate creature, and as a very strong creature that will bother with a watch that can never be torn from her. And another part of the, you know, she's almost praying, so her lips are covered. As she's speaking, she's covering her mouth.
Yes.
And but it's also a prayer. You know, that links me to, I mean, absolutely what you said about the history of art. The only, you know, male artist I can think of offhand that didn't do Susanna and the Elders in that way was Rembrandt. So maybe Goyas has some idea of equality between gender, but, you know, so few artists, it's all about the titillation. It's all about the excitement. It's all, rape is, it's a weapon of war. So I was thinking when I looked at your portrait, Gillibrand started, what was that, 2012, was it? So it takes a bill 15 years to get through Congress, and Gillibrand bill is that the military direct chain of command can't investigate their own crimes. which seems sort of common sense. That's how hard this is to shift.
That's right.
15 years, or, well, how old is that? That's now a decade of this bill. She now has the 60 votes necessary. I don't think it's come up for a vote yet, but I could be wrong. But this is such a massive struggle that since she started this, 2013, the reports of rape in the military, sexual assault, have increased 3 times. This is an appalling situation. And the amount of labor it takes in grassroots to get to this point where we can change laws is, your work's certainly a part of that. And this portrait is a part of that struggle to change. It's a part of struggle to change. And it's a beautiful, dignified, it's a stunning portrait. I wish we could show it.
There'll be links where you log on to this podcast. You will see all the links for all the work discussed today. So, yes, I know that's the challenge of a podcast. About
and the dogs. Just thinking, the first artist, you know, I can think of, you know, in terms of German expressionism, those artists went through World War One, traumatized. Otto Dix, George Grosz, John Hartfield, they're absolutely traumatized. Beckmann. And yet, within their trauma as artists, the females were always the commercial sex workers. Also, just there to be abused alongside their trauma, they are. Have a utilitarian view towards women. And even, you know, these are geniuses, they're genius artists. So Otto Dix War series, it's the best series of etchings ever. Even within that, women are still the fodder. Women are still to be consumed. They don't perceive themselves as the butcher. They perceive, the butchers perceive themselves as the victims.
Yeah.
And then in alongside that, you've got Katie Colwitz. Katie Colwitz did depict a rape. Within that time frame, she did. And her work is absolutely different because she's seeing it not in terms of sentiment, although there is a degree of sentimentality, you know, in any art, but she's depicting children, women, poverty, of war. You know, she was a radically more advanced artist than the known, you know, the more known German expressionists who exploited the female. Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to be, you know, a woman artist and you're looking for inspiration and you're seeing yourself as the commodity, as the, you know, I mean, that's what I always thought going to art school. There was one woman artist in a whole history of art. In the whole history of art, there was one woman artist. Who did the cave paintings? It's always, who did the cave paintings?
Well, you know, one of the things that with my work with depicting the invisible is that I would say that I have 2 women who have come forward to be able to share their stories, and the rest are all men. And it really comes down to this whole stigma around women and sexual assault. So most men, male veterans, their PTSD is from combat. Most women veterans' PTSD is from military sexual assault, and their stories are private and personal and humiliating and much more difficult to come forward and talk about. And so the telling of these stories is really important to inspire the next generation of women to not be afraid. And when women are afraid to tell their stories of sexual assault, then it just, the perpetrators get a pass and it's a never-ending cycle. So we just have to stop. We have to stop the cycle. I wonder what your thoughts are about women who have experienced sexual assault seeing a portrait like this, which is hanging at the Hunter Museum of American Art?
Well, firstly, I think it, because it's figurative work and it's very to say it's simple, I don't mean that to be reductive at all. It's elegant and it's straightforward. It opens a dialogue. So just because the viewer, they can see the work, they can stand in front of the work and start a discussion. They can say, me too. So I think with you depicting that and it's hanging in a museum, it becomes a positive cycle of touching people, touching the viewer. And I know it sounds trite, but empowering them because they're seeing their own self, their own history in that work. And that's what narrative reportage art can do. And it's very, very powerful. When people who never asked questions are given voice, then it opens a dialogue that creates change. You know, I'm so proud to know you. I was proud to see that work. I was just proud for us all that something so simple and elegant was so powerful. And I thank you very much for your work. It's amazing.
Too kind. Thank you so much, Sue. So, you know, I want to talk a little bit about your work. And you also work with a combination of imagery and words, which is, I think, the most powerful. You know, images on their own can be powerful, words on their own, but when they're combined in the right way, they can just be so much more powerful. And I want to discuss your piece, immortalizing the now iconic moment during the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan at the airport, where a desperate mother hands her baby over the razor wire to a Marine inside the airport. And then at the bottom of this piece, you write, red tape, which the image on its own is so powerful, but then the commentary of just those two words, it just amplifies the message tenfold. And I wonder if you could talk about that piece and how you approach combining words and imagery.
Red tape, I saw that the translators who are promised safety. It's 2010, they started visa applications. 2010.
Yeah.
And they still haven't come through. So we don't have functioning immigration, just in the best of times. And this is an emergency. So, and we have computers. That could have all happened online. You know, you get people out immediately. So that was just that was a very quick piece of art, just done in rage. So I do a lot of art just because it's therapy for me because I'm using cutting tools. So I'm cutting.
So what are the kind of tools that you use? Are you doing, was that a wood print or was that a linoleum print?
That's linoleum, but I'm working in wood because I don't know the grain. So I don't know what's going to happen with the grain. So when you print in wood, you know, there's a word for this, but I can't remember what the word is. But when there's magnetic solar flares, the tree creates a different sort of ring. So I've got the history of the wood, which I'm working with, that has its own voice. It's a living thing still. And then the images I'm putting on the wood and how they interact. But very certainly the cutting and carving, I'm baffled by the whole process, but I can't overdo it. I'm an overdoing type of artist. You know, when I draw, I'm just absolutely, it has to be perfect. But the wood cutting is an urgency. I can only go so far with it. You can overcut. It's a big mistake to overcut. It should be 50-50. That's the rule. The unofficial rule is 50% white, 50% black. And you can very easily overcut. So a lot of the process is therapy for me, the artist, and it creates a balance just making the art, you know. And I'm thinking, you know, post-traumatic stress of seeing, witnessing, being a witness is the same as, you know, if you're printmaking, it's throwing acid on an etching plate. and that's your brain. So it goes, you've got acid on your brain, and that's, it's imprinted. And what you need to do then is you need to re-traumatize other people to lessen the print in the burning in your mind. And that's sort of like a print. So I'm making this crude analogy. So you're re-traumatizing other people by what you've seen. And only when you've got a collective witnesses, can you heal. That's just my own thoughts. I'm not a therapist or anything close to a therapist, but it's sharing the trauma. So, oh, I've felt that, or we've all felt that. It's not just you. So when you do printmaking, it's multiples. When you do photography, it's multiples. You're getting the image out there, and it's re-traumatizing other people or allowing yourself to be a carrier of trauma. So that's a lot of what art making to me is about, you know, standing in a slaughterhouse watching hundreds of persons being murdered. Well, I do the art. And this is to stop it. It's using art to stop it. Just stop it. And it works. It can be stopped. So if you stop it for one, you save one. If you get one person a visa, you have one of those people a visa. It takes maybe 40 people to get one person out of Afghanistan. Yeah. You've got that person out. So, yes, we can do it when the invisible becomes visible.
Wow, it's an incredibly powerful piece. I was really moved when I saw that. It really just stopped me in my tracks. It's so powerful. I wanted to talk to you about how you come upon your subject matter. And I know that you know, I mentioned earlier that you've worked with AIDS patients and animal rights issues. And I wonder if you could talk to me about how you decide what topics to take on, and then how you approach creating work that can create that kind of awareness and inspire change.
Oh, Susan, what a sweet question. That's such a professional question. You're just born for this. You're just made for this. Well, a lot of my work in the olden days, because I'm really old now, I was working for newspapers. So I went along with the journalism. You know, a newspaper in the olden days wasn't printed by computer, and you had to make work very black and white. You have to do it very, very fast overnight. So you get the words overnight. A lot of that wasn't my choice.
I think that I heard that you did the illustrations for the New York Times at one point. Is that right?
Many. But that was all overnight work. And, you know, if the art director's sharp, which is 50-50, they're going to match you up with the article. They don't want you struggling with something that's out of your bellwick. So it's always the words, the journalism has gone alongside the work. So it's how to highlight that one story of the day. That's what printed page work is about. Well, you're going to highlight that because someone might look at it for 10 seconds. And so you're drawing them into that story. So that was my work over and over and over for decades. I would get that job at midnight to deliver by noon. So it was very quick. And then I started to much more define what I wanted to do. What was really not being covered at the time was the AIDS pandemic. Just not covered. And what's not being covered still today is the exploitation of animals for food. They're not food. Climate change, but I don't even deal with that. I think it's, you know, it's off on a tangent. But why, when there's a slaughterhouse every few blocks, pretty much, why aren't people going in slaughterhouses? Why aren't they allowed to see where their food comes from? Why is this not accessible? Prisons, same thing. Every second person has been to prison, has a relative in prison, is about to get arrested, yet these places are off the charts, impossible to cover because a lot of cases, because they're privatized. So try getting into a slaughterhouse. I dare you. It's pretty much impossible. So part of the struggle of the artist depicting the invisible is just getting in to places that are covered by maximum security. Or think about big pharma, animals used in laboratories. Try getting in. Try getting in. You know, so in the beginning of the AIDS pandemic, all these chimps that are being infected with AIDS were in laboratories. Try getting in. Try getting in. Well, I did. I did. That's my intent, is to get access. Get access. Now, unlike you, I don't have a camera, so that's easier in that regard, because no camera. No. But if you have a pencil and paper, that people can see what you're drawing. They can see what you're doing. You can say, well, is this accurate or not? So I'm still on that mission of A, being given journalism jobs. I just did one that was not published yet. That's not necessarily of my choice, but I'm really interested in it. And two, my own mission, on my own mission of doing my own work, publishing it, getting it out there.
What was one of the most harrowing or scariest experiences you had in getting into one of these places?
None of that is scary to me. None of it. I'm happier in a slaughterhouse than outside, because I'm in. I'm in its reality. I'm in reality. It's the denial of reality that frightens the heck out of me. It scares me beyond belief, and it makes me terrified. So I can be out with people I don't really know very well, and they say, oh, so you're a vegan. And do you mind if I have some meat protein? That terrorizes me. I mean, give me a slaughterhouse. Give me those guys, and they're mostly guys on the kill floor. They're in reality. Let's deal with the reality. Let's deal with, you know, you're supposedly educated and you're continuing this. Or, oh, let's vote for, oh, there's weapons of mass destruction. Let's all vote for that. What the hell happened?
Yeah.
That terrifies me, that you can go along with something without the basic, just fact-checking. Without fact-checking, you can murder and destroy the planet without even the slightest bit of... So, I mean, my lengthy screed here is that doesn't terrify me. What terrifies me is people denying this is happening. It takes 15 years for a bill to become law to protect a young woman from being raped. That terrifies me. What the hell is going on? You know, we don't have a democracy. We know that. But I didn't think we had a plutocracy. That's a bit much.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we need to act urgently. This is now urgent. And, you know, we just carry on, I suppose. We carry on doing what we're doing. Am I ranting? Just cut me off.
It's important, and this is where the power of your work comes from, the conviction of your beliefs, and it's so present in everything that you do. So my work depicting the invisible is really, I wanted to focus on the epidemic of PTSD and suicide, and my present portrait series that I'm doing called 19, The Face of a Pandemic, and it's a portrait series of people whose lives have been irrevocably changed from COVID-19. And as I say that, I'm just thinking of some of the heartbreaking stories that, you know, are being told in this series. I see that you also, because great minds think alike, you did a series, Art and Life During COVID-19. I'd really like to hear your thoughts about that body of work that you did, and the whole experience of COVID-19 and our collective trauma.
Well, you know, I did a book quite a few years ago where half of the book was about zoonotic viruses coming from our exploitation of animals. So we all knew this was happening. We all knew this was going to happen.
Interesting.
So again, it's where information, the science doesn't link to society and political change. So you have all this information where we know how zoonotic diseases work, zoonotic viruses work. We know gain of function experiments are not good. We know the labs doing gain of function are clumsy. You know, they are not state-of-the-art labs. These are all over the world. So look up gain of function. I'm not a scientist. Again, I can only do the rough outline in art of what happens, you know, with zoonotic, when we destroy the natural world, we are too close. We're too close to viruses, whereas bats can carry these viruses because of their metabolism is so speeded up, they're burning them off. We cannot. You know, and I'm still looking, well, what's the link between bat carrying coronaviruses? I presume they carry SARS too. What's the missing link here? Coronavirus, carnivorous. That's the missing link.
So in one of the images from that, there's a picture of the Grim Reaper sort of wearing a Venetian mask.
That's right.
And he has a long stick. You know, I wouldn't touch him with his 10-foot pole. And then there's a sea of people. But, you know, what you got to love about it is that the Grim Reaper is wearing a MAGA hat. So, you know, there's a charm. And it's also a searing sort of political commentary about what you're doing. Talk to me about that piece.
You're naughty.
I love that piece.
Well, it's too late for it not to be politicized. So it's politicized. And I think it's the stick in the Venetian plague doctors. And I didn't realize in art history how many artists just went through cycles of plague and they did depict it in their work, but it was so normalized they barely mentioned it, you know, and that's interesting. But the stick was to prod up the clothing to see the at arm's distance, stick distance, to see the sores.
They didn't want to get sick, so they would have a long pole and they'd to see if they're still alive.
Yeah, and the beak was stuffed with herbs that did have an antiseptic property, and they did figure out it was airborne. So there was some element there of, you know, we always assume medieval societies are medieval, but they actually weren't. If we go back to medieval times, we'd be much healthier. Well, not in terms of life expectancy, but, you know, the art's just brilliant medieval times. I'm a medievalist at heart, but I'm so glad you're doing this because, again, this is something global pandemic. We were warned. No connection between factory farms are a unicrop of zoonotic viruses, you know, and we've only survived this one, the few survivors so far, because it's not gastro. Once this is gastro, like cholera, it will go very quickly. So it's the ones from pigs, you know, avian influenza, yes. Pig zoonotic viruses are going to be very difficult for human beings to survive. And that's, you know, in terms of the meat industry, you know, there's a big outcry now. Because, you know, factory farmed hogs have their slaughter weight is when they're 3 months, three to four months, and they're 180, 200 pounds. They're not supposed to go over their slaughter weight. So when you have so many meat packers who are ill, they can't slaughter the hogs at their slaughter weight. So the hogs can't stay on factory farms. Because they're too big. They're getting bigger than their slaughter weight. They're also given antibiotics, which function as a growth hormone. So it's a speeded up, you know, we're becoming antibiotic resistant because of these antibiotics that are getting everywhere. via factory farmed animals. So this is the irony, and where it gets Orwellian and Kafkaesque is the animals have to be culled on the farm, and people are horrified. Culling healthy animals. Well, what do you think happens to the animals? A, they're not healthy. B, they go to a slaughterhouse. This is okay with you? So this is the weird, bizarre thinking that for an animal rights activist, being culled where they were born is far preferable than getting on a truck, getting on a highway, waiting outside a slaughterhouse for who knows how long in heat or freezing cold, then being stabbed in the throat after being gassed. Mm. Oh, you think this is preferable? And that's how bizarre the thinking is. That
it's interesting that you make the connection between the animals and COVID, and that's really the, you know,
it's a zoonotic. It's a zoonotic virus. So zoonotic viruses are jumper viruses, human to animal, very fast. And I don't know if this virus came out of a lab. If it did, it escaped. I have no idea. Who knows? But we shouldn't be doing gain of function, which is scientists know how dangerous zoonotics are. So they jump the gun, supposedly, and infect human cells with that virus to defeat it. But what happens is that virus can get away from them. So did this happen in this case? We don't know. I don't know why zoonotics in camels, which just died out, I don't know why that didn't spread and this did. I have no idea. But anyway, definitely the connection is there between us imposing and going into animal, non-human habitat, destroying it.
So in your body of work about COVID, what were are these some of the themes that you're addressing in it?
Well, to me, you're dealing with the impact on the human species. I'm dealing with the source of zoonotic viruses, which it's hard to understand. So how can we understand, you know, when we get so much conflicting information and then social justice, freedom or freedom? What, you know, there's many, many questions, but when you're in the middle of a forest fire, you can't really sit around debating the philosophy. So yes, we've had all these red flags. We've had them over and over and over, and here we are. So now what?
I'm going to just switch gears for a little bit because I want to talk to you about your graphic novels. And this is a really interesting format. I wonder if you could talk to me about some of the collaborations you've had in doing these sort of these graphic novels.
You're such a great interviewer. I was thinking about mink and ferrets. Mink and ferrets get COVID, spreads like wildfire. And then I'm thinking, well, which are lab animals? Oh, ferrets. So I think, you know, sometimes artists hit upon certain things accidentally. And graphic novels, I don't really do novels. I do more sequential reportage pieces with some words, although I never attempt the science myself. I actually get science people to write that, what I crudely explain. I get actual people. I just need to do the images. And so, yes, when I set forth on that journey, I need help, and I need just not a book publisher, but also access. So I work with scientists, lawyers, doctors, always. So they can say, well, no, that's not accurate. That could be accurate. Or how can we get into these populations? How can we get access to help people that are invisibilized, who have a utilitarian value under capitalism, how can we help change that? So very much, I see the work, my work, I have to test it. I have to keep testing it. So it's getting it out there. Is this working? Because you and I can make a work and we think, oh, this is really good, and it does not work. So how much of that feedback, because it's not a popularity contest either. So when you're doing a body of work, it's testing. It's not polls. It's not popularity contest. That's very bad. But it's seeing what is working in this work that you might not have seen, or what's not working. So it's very much linked to dialogue before it becomes a book, you know, before it becomes a thing, before it becomes a show. I want to test it and get it out. What's the response? What went wrong? What's going right?
Where do you bring it? Who do you show it to test?
Well, I think any artist has their group of friends. That's my first testing. Absolutely. Because they're not fans. You know, they will look at the work and they'll be objective. And so that's the first test. You know, am I getting this over? Because we can get, with you and I probably, the whole aesthetics is completely out the window. We never even get any mention of technique. That's just, forget that. We just go straight into the content. Well, actually, technique is kind of important to me. But that's completely forgotten, it's dismissed. I mean, we assume we know what we're doing with technique, but sometimes I do get overcome with my own technique, and then that's squashed by friends. If I get any ideas of being close to Katie Colwitz, that's immediately dashed. So it's that, that balance that only we, Susan, we actually think about technique.
It's very important, because you can have a really compelling message, but if you don't have a compelling visual to get somebody to experience, to invite somebody in to hear your message, doesn't matter. So the visual has to be the first thing that's compelling.
Well, technique is a test of sincerity. So that's the first thing I look for in art. And I don't expect it so much for younger artists, because it took me many decades, you know, to get really confident about technique. But I can tell if someone's sincere. Mm-hmm. They might have missed the mark, but that's what I'm looking for in the work. I've got to know you spent more than a minute making this for me to spend more than a minute looking at it. Mm-hmm. So it has to carry the weight of the content. Content and form do work together in tandem. But again, we're back to the laboratory of testing. And that's what I love about the art, is getting it out and getting the response, and also being very keen on understanding social media is not a response. That's a Pavlovian algorithm. So that's very seductive for artists. Click, click, oh, like, click, no. No. So I'm careful about that part.
Yeah, I understand. Are you working on any particularly exciting projects right now?
I don't know if it's exciting, but I was very inspired by Philippe Sands. He's a barrister. His idea of getting him and judges and other barristers, he works for the criminal court in The Hague, is getting ecocide as the equivalent of a war crime.
Wow.
So I think that's very, very important so I'm trying to do work around that theme. And from what he said, and, you know, a lot of his ideas are based on Do Trees Have Standing? It's a book. So how to figure out these puzzle pieces, because obviously America won't sign on to they won't sign on to genocide as a war crime, they won't sign on to any of this, but it can pressure governments that won't sign on. It can. They have some answering to do if they don't sign on to ecocide as a crime. So I'm very interested in the idea that animals will get rights. Right now, non-human animals have certain welfare protections, which is meaningless because that's what the law states. They aren't persons. So the idea of giving nature personhood, like many nations do have nature as personhood. They do have laws. So forests, rivers, mountains have legal personhood, as in they have rights. So to me, that's very much what I would want to do with the art moving forward.
The role of museums in really focusing on art that's trying to make an impact in these different areas. What do you see the role of museums being?
In a literal, subjective sense, I see it as younger curators getting involved. Mm-hmm. And it's the same with the law. You know, younger judges that are brought up with the idea of animal rights become judges. They're just people. Curators, younger, they're brought up, they've come about in a different culture where they can implement change. When they get in those positions, they will reflect their generation. Their generation is maybe not so much interested in the usual top-down pyramid structure of capital. So that, in just a very basic way, changes everything. And, you know, I love museums. I just, even bad ones, I love them. I love that for very little or no money, one can go in and just have that experience. I'm too squishy about museums. I can't be. I love any museums. I mean, the Metropolitan now has got a show on, it's a small show, it's political printmaking. Mm-hmm. I went there, you know, and it's miles away. It's worth it. I mean, of course, it's the Metropolitan Museum of Art, so they can actually depoliticize political art. But never mind. You know, I saw Mexican muralists, I saw anti-fascism work, I saw French Revolution images. You'd love it. The women, you know, photography, the communards, the women. Their little portraits. It was beautiful. You'd love this show. But someone curated that show and it was darn good.
I mean, I grew up, my grandmother took me to museums since I was an infant. And I just grew up at the Met and MoMA and the Whitney. And I feel like there's something that's so magical about being in a museum. You know, there's no commercials, there's no noise. And it's just this sort of almost religious experience of just being in this beautiful space with these beautiful works. And yes. It's just so powerful.
Yes, yes, yes. It's such a gift to have that and to have those people all behind the scenes dedicated to protecting that work. We're being squishy, though, because there's really social political critique we could level here. But it's after so many months of being not going to a museum. Let's be squishy.
I know. I think that's really true. That, you know, museums did, a very good job at doing a lot of outreach, doing a lot of digital programming. Yes. So we could bring into our own homes during this insane lockdown where people were isolated. And, you know, they brought a lot of content into our homes. And I'm really grateful for that. But boy, yes. There's like being there in person.
I know.
That's just like a really magic experience.
I mean, I saw the Soutine show. This was the best show I've ever seen, ever. It was at a Jewish museum in New York City. Mm-hmm. And it was the Soutine show. And I think I must have gone maybe 100 times. It was the church. It was the religious experience.
Yeah, I totally
Yeah, it was food. It's food, 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 food. Yeah. Thank you, museums.
I want to ask you about this quote about you. You've been described as an activist whose art is a blend of visual journalism, social protest, and propaganda. Do you agree?
Yes.
So do I, and very proudly so. Thank you so much for being here today. It was such a pleasure, it was such a joy to have this conversation.
Oh, Susan, you're so good at this. I mean, I always knew you're just such a poised, really good person.
Oh, thank you, sweetie. You're just so incredibly talented, and I really appreciate you sharing, you know, your insights with us today. And I want to thank everybody out there for tuning into the Depicting the Invisible podcast. And I look forward to seeing you all next time.
Thank you. Bye.